Okay, you should be on page 131 in your notes. 131. And let's open with a word of prayer. Lord, thank you for this time in your word. I pray that you will bless the time we spend studying your word, and that you will use your word to draw us closer to you, closer to one another, and more able to serve you. In Yeshua's name, amen. Now, last week, we're still dealing with that genealogy of the Messiah. Remember I said that would be the first set of prophecies we would look at. And we just got a little bit of an introduction to the line of the seed, a man named Jesse. And the question we had was, if you take Yeshua's entire genealogy, there's a lot of people in there, and there are people in there about whom there are not prophecies actually written. So why is this prophecy written about Jesse? That's one of the things we're going to be dealing with. So by way of review, since we didn't get very far with it, we're just going to read to refresh our minds what we covered last time. It won't take very long at all. And then we'll continue on with the prophecy, okay? So let's read the passage first. Now I'm going to read it in the original. I'm going to speak Hebrew from now on. How's that sound? Okay, let's go. Isaiah 11, 1 to 5. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and the branch from his roots will bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. See how it went to the second coming there? And with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. Also, righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. Now, let's... By the way, Jesse was of the tribe of Judah, so he's a potential, you know. But let's read... We're just going to read what we covered last time, and it's just this one page. As we shall see, the next person mentioned in the Tanakh as being in the line of the seed, that is, a descendant of the Messiah, is Jesse. Ancestry. Huh?
Descendant means come
after. Right.
To be ancestor.
Wait.
The ancestor.
A descendant of the Messiah? Oh, it should be. Yeah, thank you. I need a pen, quickly. I need a real quick pen. Thank you. Now, what do you call it? Not a descendant, but a
ancestor.
Thank you very much. If you see any typos, let me know, because this is going to turn into a book. And at some point, make sure everybody puts their X if you just came in. Okay, here we go. There are many others who are also potentially in the line of the seed. What makes Jesse so significant that he is prophetically noted as a descendant of the Messiah? Okay. The answer is given in Isaiah. I did it again. Alzheimer's is setting in. Boy, this is real bad. Okay. The answer is given in Isaiah 11, 1 to 5. The condition of Israel at the time of Jesse and beyond has messianic significance. So one of the things we're going to want to look at is the circumstances that were taking place in Israel during his day, Jesse's day, and Messiah's day. There's a connection there we're going to see. But first we will look at some important information given to us about Jesse in the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth, a wonderful love story, culminates in the marriage of Ruth and Boaz, a man from the tribe of Judah. At the end of the book of Ruth, a short genealogy is given as follows. Now these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nashon, and to Nashon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. So we can see that one of the things already that's significant here is that Jesse was an ancestor of King David, which has messianic implications because of the Davidic covenant. Okay, now let's continue. As the genealogy indicates, Boaz was the grandfather of Jesse, who was the father of David, the king of Israel. During his reign of king, as king, God, and it should be entered, not enters. During his reign as king, God entered into a very important covenant with David, a covenant that contains important prophetic information about the Messiah. We will study this covenant in the next section. The prophecy about Jesse in Isaiah foreshadows this covenant and contains important information about the Davidic dynasty and also about the Messiah. Some translations render the Hebrew word Megiza in verse 1, you see, stem. You see, when we go back there, it says, then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. Okay, so the New American Standard, the New King James, and the King James Version all do that. However, the word Megiza comes from a root meaning to cut down. It's to cut down trees. It is the trunk or stump of a tree that has been felled or cut down. That's a more accurate stump would be a more accurate translation. In the Bible, a luxurious fruit-bearing tree is used as a picture of prosperity. For example, Psalm 1:3, he shall be like a tree planted by rivers of water that yields its seed and its fruit in its season. Okay. A stump would indicate the opposite, poverty and a lowly position in society. Everybody got that so far? Now watch. In chapter 10, Isaiah prophesies that Assyria will be used by God to discipline Israel for its rebellion. Assyria is pictured as an axe and a saw, both tools used to chop trees and to stump. That's in Isaiah 10:15. The devastation that Assyria brings upon Israel will reduce it metaphorically to a stump. The reduction of the Davidic dynasty to a mere stump is an accurate depiction of its condition when Messiah was born. For though it still existed, it had been without royal power for nearly 600 years. So you can see the parallel here between what happened in Israel, the conditions in Israel in the time of Jesse and in the time of Messiah. However, God's purpose in this royal line had not been set aside. From the stump of Jesse would come a branch that would bear fruit. This branch is the Messiah. And notice there's some prophecies about Messiah being the branch. Here's Isaiah 4:2. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. And then also in Jeremiah 23:5-6. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely. Notice we're moving to the second coming now. That's a second coming prophecy. And this is the name by which he shall be called, the Lord our righteousness. The reducing of the Davidic dynasty to a stump would lead to the coming of the Messiah, who was born in poverty, but would ultimately prosper as the king of Israel. So you see the parallel between the time of Jesse and the time of Messiah here, and especially Messiah's background. Yeshua's impoverished beginning is confirmed by the nature of the offering his parents gave when they brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. Now, in Luke 2, we have the story of when his parents came to present him to the Lord. Ready? And when the days for the purification according to the law of Moses were completed, they brought him, Yeshua, this is Joseph and Mary, up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every first male that opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice according to what was said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. So when Mary and Joseph went up to present Yeshua, their sacrifice consisted of a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons, right? Now, read with me. A pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons was the offering given by poor people. And let's confirm that in the law. Let's go to the book of Leviticus. And when the days of purification are completed for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the doorway of the tent of meeting a one-year-old lamb for a burnt offering and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering. Then he shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her, and she shall be cleansed from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, whether a male or female. But if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take two turtle doves or two young pigeons, the one for a burnt offering and the other for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her, and she shall be clean. So you can see that Yeshua was born in poverty. And so this prophecy of Jesse bears a relationship. Not only is he in the Davidic line, but his life and times parallel the life and times of Yeshua, yes? Yeah, but that didn't really make him rich. You know, a little gold here and there. Excuse me? Oh, no. They just bought a little gift of gold. Yeah, they didn't bring like a talent of gold or anything like that. No, not enough. Okay. What? When?
I don't think there's scriptural backing for saying that.
For saying what?
Well,
the reason we know it couldn't have been a lot is because of the offering they gave. Obviously, if it had been enough gold to make them rich, they wouldn't have offered the offering that they did. They'd have been rich and they'd have offered a lamb.
The Magi didn't get there
until
later.
Yeah, but that's irrelevant to the fact as to whether they were rich or poor. They clearly were poor.
On the eighth day of his, Jesus'
life. Yeah, so they were clearly poor. If the Magi had bought like a talent of gold, that was a lot of gold, then they would have not offered the offering that they gave.
When did the Magi get there?
4 o'clock. They got there shortly after he was born, probably between days 1 and 7. They got there pretty soon after he was born. I wouldn't be surprised if it was like day 2 or 3 or so. Yeah. Excuse me? What? When? Who? When?
When the gospel says the family was back in Nazareth when the Magi came through.
Oh, that's right. I was thinking about the wise men. You're right. Thank you for... I am corrected.
The wise men and the Magi are the same.
The shepherds got there.
The shepherds. I was thinking of the shepherds. Right. Let's close with a word of prayer. This is not good. Okay, let's go. All right, but the point we're getting here is we can see the significance of this prophecy concerning David, Jesse. Number one, he's in the Messianic line. And number two, the description of the life and times of Jesse parallels the life and times of Yeshua. The passage goes on to describe the nature and work of the Messiah. The Spirit of the Lord, that's the Holy Spirit, will rest on him. This signifies that the Holy Spirit will empower him for his work, which will be characterized by wisdom, understanding, counsel, power, knowledge, and the fear of the Lord. These characteristics of the Messiah complement Isaiah 9:6, where it says, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace." So there's kind of a parallel there. The Messiah will be characterized by the fear of the Lord and will delight in it. The word "the" doesn't seem right. It should be "that." Wait, the Yeshua showed perfect obedience to God the Father in contrast with the Jewish leaders of his day who were unconcerned about. It shouldn't be there, period. Yeah. So Yeshua should be the first word of that sentence. All right, see, the Messiah as king will judge the world impartially and with righteousness. He will not oppress the afflicted and poor as did human leaders. Whereas the poor will be treated with fairness and dignity, the wicked will be slain with the breath of his lips. And Messiah's reign will be characterized by righteousness and faithfulness as if they were an integral part of his clothing as a belt or a sash. So you can see that this little prophecy about Jesse really has a lot of information. Number one, it places him in the descendancy of David. Number two, the life and times of Jesse parallel the life and times of Yeshua. And number three, it tells us information about the Messiah. So it's a very interesting prophecy. Did everybody put their axe? Because I saw new people come in. You don't get raptured if you don't put your axe. It's a new rule, I've decided. Okay. Everybody all right so far, except me? Okay. Now we're going to go on to the next prophecy. And in the last, what we just looked at, Jesse, it said we're going to look at the prophecy concerning David, and that's what we're going to look at now. Now, this is a very important, they're all important, but this is a real important one because it involves one of the covenants we looked at. So, Jesse, so far, how do we go? Let's see. Eve, right? And then who comes after Eve? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Jesse, and now we're going to be up to David. Okay? Well, okay, Boaz. I'll give you Boaz. There's a surcharge for Boaz. Okay, ready? In the last section, we saw that Jesse was in the line of the seed. That is, here we go with this descendant nonsense again. And he should be a, what's that word? Well, a descendant comes after. But Jesse came before. What's the word for before? Ancestor. My grandmother was Kitty. Okay, an ancestor of the Messiah. We also saw that Jesse had a son named David. David was to become king of Israel and, as we shall see in this section, was the next person in the line of the seed who was Yeshua the Messiah. Okay. There are two passages of Scripture that are significant here. 2 Samuel 7:12 to 16. And 1 Chronicles 17:11 to 14. They're very similar to one another. They both contain the Davidic covenant, but there's some significant differences as well, as we'll see. So we're going to look at both of these passages. These are parallel passages, similar to each other, but with some important differences. They comprise what is commonly referred to as the Davidic covenant. We will look at each of these passages, but first some background material will be helpful. In these passages, David informs the prophet Nathan that he intends to build the house for the Lord, the temple. He wanted to build the temple, and Nathan approves. Nathan approved of it. However, the word of the Lord came to Nathan that night and informed him that David would not be the one to build the temple. Anybody know why the Lord told David he would not build the temple? He was a man of war. Right, so that's why he disallowed him from building the temple. Okay, God then instructs Nathan to go to David and speak to him on his behalf. The words that Nathan speaks to David comprise the Davidic covenant. Now, we're going to read the Davidic covenant from 2 Samuel 7, 12 to 16 first. We'll deal with that passage first. Now, this is Nathan speaking to David on behalf of God, okay? When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you. Now, in that particular case, the descendant... Well, that's right. In that case, the descendant is Solomon. And we'll see, that's not Messiah, that's Solomon. After you, who will come forth with you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build the house for my name. Who built the first temple? Solomon. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. There's that Davidic covenant coming into play. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But, and this is significant, my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it away from Saul. That's significant because Solomon messed up quite a bit. He turned to idolatry later in his life. Whom I removed from before you. And now here's the crux of the Davidic covenant. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. Now this means two things. It doesn't mean that there will always be a descendant of David on the throne. What it does mean is the line of David will remain intact until that final king comes. You got it? And that's important that the line of David remain intact and that it remain, and that one who is in that line be able to establish that they're in that line. Okay? Right. A, in this passage, the covenant focuses on David's son Solomon. David is told that after he dies, he will establish Solomon's king forever, that he is God. And that it is Solomon who will build the temple. Verses 12 to 14. The descendant mentioned in the passage is Solomon is verified in 1 Chronicles 28:6. And he, God, said to me, your son Solomon is the one who shall build my house and my courts. For I have chosen him to be a son to me, and I will be a father to him. So Solomon did, in fact, build the temple. The temple was probably the most valuable building ever built. You read the description of the temple Solomon built. I mean, the whole thing was gold. The prosperity of Israel during the days of Solomon, silver wasn't really even worth it. Silver was like a rock. There was so much gold. Okay. The relationship between God and Solomon will be a paternal relationship. God will discipline Solomon when he is disobedient. However, God will not take the kingdom away from Solomon as he did from Saul. Okay? Finally, in verse 16, God affirms and expands upon what he said in verse 13. I will establish the throne of his, Solomon's kingdom forever. The promise is now given directly to David. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. That's the Davidic covenant. D, the establishment of David's throne forever has important messianic implications. We have already seen that Messiah will be a king, right? And that the royal line shall proceed from the tribe of Judah. Although there would be a period of time when there was not a descendant of David ruling as king of Israel, this passage indicates that the royal line will remain intact. Ultimately, the royal line will culminate in the Messiah who will rule as king forever, fulfilling God's promise to David. This kingship of Messiah is confirmed in Psalm 110 and Psalm 2. Read with me, Psalm 110, 1 and 2. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make thine enemies a footstool for thy feet. The Lord will stretch forth thy strong scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of thine enemies. And then in Psalm 2, 7 to 11, I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, thou art my son, today have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as thine inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron, thou shalt shatter them like earthenware. Now therefore, O king, show discernment, take warning, O judges of the earth, worship the Lord with reverence, and rejoice with trembling. Okay, now that's the Davidic covenant as it's mentioned in 2 Samuel. Now let's go to the next one, the Davidic covenant in 1 Chronicles. In 2 Samuel, the focus is primarily on David's son Solomon. 2 Chronicles 17 focuses on a distant descendant of David, the Messiah. Notice the difference between 2 Samuel 7 and 1 Chronicles 17. Now watch the difference. 2 Samuel 7. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. Now watch 1 Chronicles. And it shall come about when your days are fulfilled that you must go to be with your fathers, that I will set up one of your descendants after you who shall be one of your sons, and I will establish his kingdom. See, it's specifically talking about this descendant, that his kingdom will be established. So there's a difference there. One is talking about Solomon, one is talking about Messiah. As we can see, 2 Samuel 7:12 deals with a specific descendant of David, Solomon, who will come forth from him. Conversely, 1 Chronicles 17:11 deals with a more distant descendant of David, one of your descendants who shall be of your sons. This descendant is the Messiah. Also, whereas 2 Samuel 7:13 says, I will establish the throne of his, Solomon's kingdom forever, guaranteeing David a perpetual royal line, 1 Chronicles 7:14 says, I will settle him in my house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forever. Thus, 1 Chronicles 7:14 guarantees David more than a perpetual line. It also guarantees that one of David's descendants will actually rule as king forever. This king is the Messiah. We may now conclude that the Messiah will be a descendant of King David. We may also conclude that the Messiah would have to come before 70 CE, when the temple was destroyed, and with it the records that would verify the royal lineage of the Messiah. So nobody coming today could claim to be the Messiah because they can't verify their lineage. Everybody got that so far? Now this was a big one. Did everybody follow it okay? Okay, good. Did you? I'll tell you this, I think this one bears reading over again. Compare the two passages, see the differences and the similarities.
Because I thought they were both referring to Messiah.
Well, do you see how it says, he shall build a house for me and so forth, and I will discipline? You know, the Messiah didn't have to be disciplined. So... Little louder, I'm old.
No, I've never
They don't read it. They don't even read it. Most Jewish people, if you read that to them, it would be the first time in their entire lives they ever heard it. All right, now, so far, here's what we have. Eve. Now, if you want to, you know, Noah, you could put him in there if you want, because obviously he has to be in the line. But there's no... Okay, Eve. Then we have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. Then we have Judah. And then we have Jesse. And then we have David. Now, there's something about the line of David that's very important, and that's what we're going to deal with. So far, what we've seen is that if you are a descendant of David, you are in the Messianic line, right? But there's a kind of like little exception to that we're going to learn about right now. So on page 139, the rejection of Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim was a descendant of David. Now let's read. And Pharaoh Necho, this is the passage, this is the prophecy, 2 Kings 23. And Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the place of Josiah his father, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. But he took Jehoahaz away and brought him to Egypt, and he died there. So Jehoiakim gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land in order to give the money at the command of Pharaoh. So you can see Jehoiakim was not a godly man, not a godly king. He exacted the silver and gold from the people of the land, each according to his valuation, to give it to Pharaoh Necho. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Zebediah, the daughter of Pedaiah of Ramah. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. So Jehoiakim was an evil king. He is in the Messianic line, but he was a very evil king. He didn't trust in God. He paid tribute to Pharaoh. He taxed the people to pay this. He was very ungodly. Now, read with me. By the way, just so you know, remember the divided kingdom, and now you have Israel and Judah? How many kings of Israel were righteous?
None.
How about Judah? I think it's a little more, 8. I'm not sure, I'll have to look that up, but very few. Okay. Josiah was one of the few godly kings of Judah. He made a number of reforms in Judah, including the removal of idols from the house of the Lord. Can you imagine how bad it got? In the temple, they had idols. It really got bad. And that's not even the half of it. You should hear some of the stuff they did. The breaking down of the houses of the male cult prostitutes in the house of the Lord. I mean, can you imagine? They turned the house of the Lord into a homosexual brothel. Was that how you say it? Brothel. And the reinstitution of the Passover. They had not been celebrating the Passover for a long time. While Josiah was ruling, Pharaoh Necho II went to visit his ally, the king of Assyria. During Pharaoh's journey, Josiah went out to meet, and that means do battle with him biblically, in order to prevent Assyria or Egypt from regaining strength and attacking Judah. Unfortunately, Josiah was killed in the ensuing battle. When Pharaoh Necho II defeated Josiah at Megiddo, Judah fell under Egyptian control. The officials of the land of Judah appointed Josiah's son Jehoahaz king in place of his father. He was an evil king and apparently not cooperative with Pharaoh. Pharaoh imprisoned him and sent him to Egypt, where he eventually died. Necho then appointed Jehoahaz's older brother, Eliakim, king of Judah, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim did not follow his father's good example, doing evil in the sight of the Lord. He practiced idolatry, and in order to pay tribute to Pharaoh, Jehoiakim heavily taxed the people of Judah. Okay, so everybody see what's happening here historically so far? Okay, continue. Jeremiah despised Jehoiakim for his wickedness and sharply denounced him. Jeremiah's denunciation of Jehoiakim climaxed with a curse placed on Jehoiakim by God. Now, this is the significant prophecy. Listen to this. Remember, Jehoiakim is in the kingly line, right? O land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. So there's a curse placed on Jehoiakim, and what that curse basically says is, although he's in the kingly line, none of his descendants will be the Messiah. Now, there's others in the kingly line. It's not as though the kingly line is going to be eradicated. But there's a curse placed on him. And so when somebody comes and claims to be the Messiah and they check his genealogy, it's not just enough that it go back to David. It has to avoid Jehoiakim. Otherwise, he can't be king. See it? Okay, continue. And by the way, this is going to answer for us. You know how there's two genealogies of the Lord in the Bible? Some people say, why do you need two? Wouldn't one be sufficient? This is going to deal with the fact there's two of them. It's very important. Okay, watch. Though Jehoiakim did have children, he was considered to be childless because none of his offspring would be allowed to sit on the throne of David as king of Israel. This prophecy has important messianic implications. Joseph's line came through Shealtiel, who was a son of Jehoiakim. You see that? So Joseph, the husband of Mary, this genealogy went back to David through Jehoiakim. That's a problem. See it? Now watch. Therefore, had Yeshua been a physical descendant of Joseph, he would have been disqualified as Israel's king. This leads to the question, who then was Yeshua's father? And also to the question, does the curse of Jehoiakim apply to Yeshua? Throughout the genealogy recorded by Matthew, Matthew uses the same formula for advancing the lineage of Yeshua. For example, in verse 15 we read, and this is the formula he uses, the whole genealogy. Eliud was the father of Eliezer, Eliezer the father of Mathan, and Mathan the father of Jacob. He keeps saying the father of, the father of, the father of. However, when we come to verse 16b, the formula suddenly changes. Watch what it says. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Miriam, by whom Yeshua was born, who is called the Messiah. Notice Joseph is not called Yeshua's father. Okay, now continue to read with me. Notice that Matthew makes an abrupt change in the formula. He does not say that Joseph was the father of Yeshua because Yeshua's conception was not the result of Joseph having relations with Miriam. Joseph was not Yeshua's father, and thus the curse of Jehoiakim, which might have come through Joseph, was avoided. See how that happened? Now watch this. Well, let's continue. The question concerning Yeshua's paternal parents still remains. Immediately following Yeshua's genealogy, Matthew answers that question by recording the story of the virgin birth. You see what he's doing here? He gives the genealogy through Joseph, disqualifies Joseph from being Yeshua's father, leaving open the question, who's Yeshua's father, and right away gives the story of the virgin birth. Now read with me. Now the birth of Yeshua the Messiah was his father's. When his mother Miriam had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child by the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man and not wanting to disgrace her, desired to put her away secretly. But when he had considered this, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Miriam as your wife, for that which has been conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit, and she will bear a son, and you shall call his name Yeshua. In Hebrew, Yeshua translates God saves. you shall call his name Yeshua, for it is he who will save his people from their sins. According to Matthew 1:18 to 21, Yeshua's father was not Joseph, nor was his father any other man. Yeshua was conceived not through a human male, but by God, making Yeshua the Son of God and God the Father of Yeshua. Now, this leaves another question and answer. If Joseph was not Yeshua's father, then was Yeshua truly a descendant of David? If he was not David's descendant, Yeshua had no right to David's throne and could not be the Messiah. This question is answered in Luke 3. The genealogy of Yeshua recorded in Luke 3 traces Yeshua's lineage through Miriam, who was descended from David through the line of his son Nathan. Miriam's genealogy does not pass through Jehoiakim. Therefore, Yeshua was a descendant of David, but was not subject to the curse of Jehoiakim. He was thus eligible to sit on David's throne as king, and was thereby eligible to be the Messiah. Isn't that interesting how God worked that out? Yeah. They might have been referring to Joseph, but Joseph was not his father. I haven't seen it, but you can see clearly the Bible demonstrates that he's not subject to the curse of Jehoiakim, but is a descendant of David. Yeah. And that's why the two genealogies are there, and that's why the genealogy tracing back from Joseph is immediately followed by the story of the virgin birth. Who is his father? It's God. Yeah, the fact that he doesn't have any human descendancy is refuted by the fact that he has a genealogy that goes back from Mary, and that Mary was in fact his mother. Mary was his mother. She gave birth to him. He was a human being. Now, God, in some way, we don't understand, what's the word, inseminated Mary? We don't know how that took place, but that's a miracle. Okay, now, we're finished now with the genealogy aspect of the study. Now, we can see again it goes, Eve, if you want Noah. We know that Noah, there's no specific prophecy, but then it goes Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Jesse, David, but not through Jehoiakim. Okay? Questions? Okay, now. Yeah?
In some of the lists, it's not complete, is it? I remember.
Well, in Jewish, the way the Jewish people used to do genealogies is they would often do what's called generation skipping. Yeah. They would do that with names, too. For example, in Matthew calls Jesus. He says, the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. There's a lot of generation skipping right there. Yeah. And Matthew gives Jesus' genealogy in three sets of seven. Now, there's more than 21, but he does that because they memorized a lot in those days. And so he says, we're seven generations, we're seven generations, we're seven generations. It makes it easier to memorize. And he gives key aspects of it. So they did practice what was called generation skipping in those days. Okay, next prophecy we're going to deal with. A prophet like Moses. Deuteronomy 18, 15 to 19. This is Moses speaking to the Jewish people. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me, like Moses, from among you, from your countrymen, you shall listen to him. This is according to all that you asked of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see this great fire anymore, lest I die. And the Lord said to me, they have spoken well. I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. Okay? So that's the prophecy of a prophet like Moses. Okay, now, watch. This one's pretty interesting. In this passage, God promises Moses that he will one day raise up a prophet like him from among the Jewish people. The Jewish people understood that this prophet would be the greatest of all prophets. He would be the Messiah. And that's, remember the question in the New Testament, are you the prophet? Surely this one is the prophet. Okay? Okay, let's do a little background first. A, Moses was unique among all of the other Old Covenant prophets. In Numbers 12:2, Miriam and Aaron did not agree with Moses' marriage to a Cushite woman. This resulted in their bringing a complaint before Moses, saying, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" See, they were jealous. This complaint results in God, should be resulted. I'm going to make all these corrections. Intervening on behalf of Moses, expressing Moses' unique status among the prophets. Now watch. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent, and he called Aaron and Miriam. When they had both come forward, boy, I'd be shaking in my boots. He said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak to him with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him, I speak mouth to mouth, even openly and not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses?" Ooh, would I be, I'd be scared to death. The above passage tells us that whereas God spoke to the other prophets indirectly through dreams, visions, and other various... typo city, and other various methods, he spoke uniquely to Moses mouth to mouth. That is, Moses received revelation directly from God. Additionally, when God spoke to Moses, Moses beheld the form of the Lord. The reason for Moses' unique status is he is faithful in all my household. The passage also notes something else unique about Moses. He was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. Verse 3. In the book of Deuteronomy, we're also told something very interesting about Moses. Now, read this. This is very interesting. "Now, Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him, and the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, for all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land, and for all the mighty power and for all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of Israel." Now, it doesn't stand to reason that this was written by like Joshua. Of course, to say since then no prophet has arisen, time has to pass. There has to be some prophets first. So it doesn't make any sense that either Moses or Joshua would have written this. Okay, continue. Well, I have it here. "It is unlikely that Moses or Joshua wrote this because in their day, had not yet been any prophets with whom Moses could be compared. Many theologians believe that the Old Covenant scriptures were compiled by Ezra, circa, that means approximately, 450 BCE. It is also believed that Ezra inserted editorial comments into the Old Covenant, for example, the recording of the death of Moses. And that's at the top of page 144. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him there. He buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no man knows his burial place to this day. So God buried Moses. God himself buried Moses. Well, just continue reading with me and we'll see what happened. Deuteronomy 24:10, which states, since then no prophet has arisen. Well, no, Joshua couldn't have written that because Joshua was, he wouldn't have known that Moses, remember, was not allowed to cross over into the land. And so Moses and Joshua were separated when Moses died. And so Joshua would not even have known that he had buried him in the valley in the land of Moab. He couldn't have had that information.
I don't remember. Why was Moses not allowed to have the way he was in such faith?
Because he hit the rock instead of speaking to it. Okay. Deuteronomy 24:10, which states, since then no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, was probably one of the editorial inserts made by Ezra. This means that as of 450 BCE, the prophet like Moses had not yet come. Ezra and the Jewish people were still looking for the prophet. Furthermore, in John 1:19 to 21, the Jewish leaders sent priests and Levites to John, the last of the old covenant prophets, asking him, "Are you the prophet?" John answered, "No." Also, when John was in prison and heard of the works of the Messiah, he sent disciples to him to ask, "Are you the expected one?" These scriptures indicate that in Yeshua's day, the Jewish people were still waiting for the prophet to come. None of the old covenant prophets were the prophet like Moses, that is the Messiah. Yes?
Number 3 is Deuteronomy 34.
Where? Number 3, Deuteronomy what? Where I say 24:10, mm-hmm. And what is it?
34:10.
Oh, 34:10. Thank you. See, this is going to be helpful when I make my New York Times bestseller book. Okay. Now, let's see how he was a prophet like Moses. Number 3. We will now consider the similarities between Moses' ministry and Yeshua's ministry that qualify Yeshua as a prophet like Moses. First of all, Yeshua was a prophet. The role of a prophet was to speak to the people on behalf of God. This involved a twofold ministry. One, to preach, challenging Israel to be faithful to her Lord. And two, to utter predictions from the Lord. In order for a man to be a true prophet, 100% of his prediction had to come true. What happened if they didn't? Stoned. Like Moses, Yeshua was a prophet. He spoke the words of God to the people, and his predictions, for example, Yeshua's predictions about his death and resurrection, came true. Okay, second, Yeshua was a redeemer. When God raised up a redeemer to free his people from bondage of slavery in Egypt, Moses was the man chosen by God to lead them out of captivity. Likewise, Yeshua's death redeemed his people from the bondage of slavery. So they're both prophets, they're both redeemers. Yeshua was a meditator. God originally spoke directly to the Jewish people. The sound of God's voice was so overwhelming to them that they asked Moses to mediate for them so they would not hear God's voice directly. Rather, they would hear God's words spoken through Moses. So Moses was a mediator. As the following passages indicate, Yeshua was also a mediator. For there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man, Yeshua, the Messiah. I got to make a note. Okay. Hebrews 8:6. But now he, Yeshua, has obtained a more excellent ministry, by as much as he also is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. And then Hebrews 9:15, and for this reason he, Yeshua, is the mediator of a new covenant, in order that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. Okay, next, Hebrews. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, to the general assembly and the church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, and to Yeshua, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood which speaks better of Abel. Also, both Yeshua and Moses were intercessors. A. During their travels from Egypt to the Promised Land, the Jewish people were often disobedient to God. It was only because of Moses' intercession on their behalf that they escaped God's judgment and survived. Remember, at one point, Moses, God was going to destroy them all? As the following passage indicates, Yeshua was also an intercessor. And the former priests, on the one hand, existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing. But he, Yeshua, on the other hand, because he abides forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Hence, also, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he also lives to make intercession for them. Now, those are the main and the most significant comparisons between Yeshua and Moses. There's one other thing that's kind of interesting. There were three offices in Israel. The priest, and the priest represented the people before God. The prophet represented God before the people. And the king ruled on behalf of God. No one ever had all three offices at once. David was a prophet and a king, but he wasn't a priest. Okay? The only one we can say with certainty that was all three is Yeshua. He's a king, he's a priest, and he's a prophet. Now, Moses was a prophet and a priest. He represented the people before God and God before the people. And some would argue that although the kingship in Israel didn't begin until Saul, Moses was what we would call a de facto king. That means he was, although he wasn't legally a king, he had all the authority and privileges of a king. So that could be another similarity. Yeah, you had something? Right, because no other prophet did that.
I know. I'm thinking that is the hugest thing.
That's very huge. I agree. That's probably the most significant thing of all. Yes?
Moses was kind of referred to as a Messiah.
Well, he was referred to as a redeemer. He redeemed, God through Moses redeemed Israel from the bondage of slavery in Egypt. Where are you looking right now?
The passage in Hebrews 12, verse 24.
Well, the blood of Abel, what he's saying there is, when Abel died, his blood cried out from the ground to God,
right,
which is pretty significant. And what he's saying here, the blood of Yeshua speaks even more clearly than that. Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of interesting. Yes?
I thought no man has spoken to God.
Yeah, when it says face-to-face there, it's an anthropomorphism. He didn't see God's face in the sense that, you know, It's the context would define it differently. It's an anthropomorphism. It's not seeing God in his full glory, because if that had happened, because remember Moses said, "Show me your glory," and God said, "No man can see my face and live." So obviously, when he said he spoke to Moses face to face, it didn't mean that Moses saw God in his full glory. It meant that he spoke to him directly, as opposed to through dreams and so forth. Yes?
The fact that Moses was at the Mount of Transfiguration.
Right.
That's kind of significant, too. That,
sure. Moses and Elijah.
Yeah. And that they were.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works out. I mean, that they were there. And
those two. Why those two? That's a good question.
It's a good witness.
Yeah. Yes?
This skips back to the previous section on the lineage of Yeshua. When we talk about Miriam.
Right.
Is that another name for Mary?
Miriam is the Jew, her Jewish name. Mary is would be a Greek name.
Okay.
Yeah, Miriam is the Jewish name. When she walked down the street and people addressed her, they addressed her as Miriam. That's the Jewish name.
I'm just curious, at the Mount of Transfiguration, did they have name tags on?
Well, we're going to have name tags in heaven. We're going to have name tags in heaven.
Yeah, good.
And we're also going to have cards we can give people, kind of like business cards.
Good.
The Bible doesn't tell us how it came to be that the disciples recognized Moses and Josh and Elijah. More than likely, it was by listening to this conversation they were having. I mean, if I heard you having a conversation with somebody that I didn't recognize, after enough time, I'd know who it was.
Yeah, maybe Yeshua said, hey,
Moses and Elijah, how you doing today?
Yeah.
I doubt he said that, but whose pen did I borrow?
Mine.
Thank you. Okay, let me do this real quickly so I don't have to lose my brain.